For the week of May 22nd, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 322, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the doghouse, I'm Michael Giltz.
Yeah, Michael, I feel like we should start off this show fighting, really. We should just have a quick argument to start us off.
Yeah, no, I don't think your argument that, like, becoming shock jocks would actually bring us more viewers.
Well, yeah, because we had this debate last week, and all of a sudden we got more email and responses. We actually got comments on our website, showbizsandbox.com. We got people commenting, which I loved, by the way. So please do go to showbizsandbox.com and leave comments on episodes. It's a great way to let us know what you're thinking.
So yes, I apologize for interrupting you.
What?
I apologize for interrupting you.
No, I was trying to time it so that I could interrupt you.
Nice try. You have to learn from me, the master. To explain how we do the show, sometimes, you know, we don't map out our conversations and what we're going to say. We have show notes and we know what we're going to talk about. And, you know, by and large, we know why somebody has included something so that when we talk on the show, which is the main time we talk each week, we don't hang out. You're in LA, I'm in New York. It's during the recording of the show. However, sometimes there's a topic and we don't really quite know what we think about it, or I'm not sure why you've included it, or I don't understand it well enough to talk about it, or vice versa. So we have a discussion before the show, and that's where we hash it out, and we argue, and I'm stupid and annoying and obnoxious, and it goes on. Sometimes we have that discussion after the show, and sometimes we have it during the show. When it happens before, it helps us clarify where we stand and what we're thinking and what our points are, and then maybe we get to them quicker and more cogently.
Right.
When we do it during the show, because we haven't really hashed it out yet for whatever reason, because we're busy, sometimes it gets, I said, after that conversation last, I said, cut it. It was really boring.
In Michael's defense, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but in Michael's defense, you did say last week, hey, you know what? We kind of hashed that out during the show. We probably should have done that before. You might want to cut that out. I was in Cannes. We didn't have a chance to hash anything out. I didn't even have a chance to research it as thoroughly as I would like, which is this topic of how European films travel. And you know what? I didn't have time, so I didn't cut it out. And you know what? We got more feedback from that one show. Everybody from Raul Baril to Greg Bridle will be reading some of them at the end of the show there. It was amazing.
They knew I was annoying, but they didn't realize how annoying. And I think that's why you didn't cut it. I know you were calm, but I think you wanted people to know what you have to actually put up with behind the scenes.
Well, maybe, just a little.
So yeah, I'll try to interrupt less. We'll edit more. But happily, people did cover and review the show even before. If they had reviewed it today, they'd probably give it 3 stars or 2 stars. But we did have people who went onto iTunes in North America and reviewed the show.
Yeah, we can't actually figure out what the ratings and reviews are in other countries because, of course, iTunes is very geographic specific, and we can't access those ratings and reviews. But
I thought they would be worldwide.
Yeah, I thought so too. But FSU9988, thank you for the 5-star review. Internet,
despite the fact that you're FSU, and I imagine I'm UF, University of Florida, and you might be Florida State University. So
maybe.
Nice of you to reach across the border to a rival.
There might just be somebody named Frank Sam. I don't know what a U last
perhaps
name would be. Yeah.
Perhaps.
Internet Marine and J Penn and Tony K2342. Thank you all for your 5-star reviews. Those are the most recent reviews, and we'll try and read out the names of those who are reviewing us more frequently.
And you don't have to give us a 5-star review, anything 4-star. You know, we're happy if you just acknowledge the show exists. 3-star review. Michael, shut up. That's okay.
Well, hopefully you don't shut up this week, because we're going to wrap up our coverage of the Cannes Film Festival, which ended over the weekend with the awarding of the Palme d'Or, the festival's top prize. We'll tell you who won all the big awards in Cannes this year and really what that might mean for those films, if anything. We'll also tell you who the king of the Broadway box office was this past season, and no, it wasn't Hamilton. During Inside Baseball, we'll talk about two struggles for power, the one that ended at HBO and the one that's going on at Viacom. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, sort of. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world because X-Men Apocalypse has not opened up yet in North America. It's opening up this weekend, but it's in 75 territories, and it is the number one movie around the world, according to Rentrak. We have a link in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it. X-Men Apocalypse, poor reviews, but $103 million worldwide.
It's getting poor reviews here in the States or overseas?
The reviews I've seen have been poor. The trades, I don't know if they count as U.S., but it hasn't made, it's not like the U.S. hates it and other countries love it. It's getting mixed reviews.
All right.
And number two around the world is a movie that's getting pretty good reviews, the Angry Birds movie. Perhaps the most successful franchise of all time sprung from an app.
Okay, so that's a lot of qualifiers for something that has a category of like one entrant.
That's right. It's a game, a movie spun off from a game. So it's like a video game, but it happens to be a phone game on an app. There you go. Angry Birds movie, $94 million over the weekend, $150 million worldwide. It's already doubled its budget. This is a big success story. And who would have predicted it? Not me.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, when I saw the first, I saw like about 20 minutes of this movie and I went, oh my gosh, this does not look good at all. But, you know, it came in number one at the box office here in North America over the weekend. And apparently it's quite good. People who've seen it really like it.
Well, it's, I don't think it's quite, it's like, it's okay. It's not bad. It should have been a disaster and it's not. At number three around the world is Captain America Civil War. $63 million over the weekend, which takes it beyond $1 billion. $1,053 million. That's one of just three movies in the top 10 that worldwide that looked like they could hit $1 billion potentially. That one already did. Jungle Book is also in there, and Zootopia. We'll get to them soon. And number four is Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising. $27 million over the weekend, $52 million and counting. A big success story for Seth Rogen and Zac Efron.
Well, and Seth Rogen, I just watched Preacher last night, which is on AMC. It's a new series on AMC, and I'm watching it, and there are the credits, and it's produced by Seth Rogen, directed by Seth Rogen and his producing and directing partner. He's a busy guy.
Yes, and, you know, Freaks and Geeks, one of the greatest shows of all time and certainly one of the greatest casts.
Well, look at what the cast has gone on to do.
That's what I just said.
Okay.
So at number five,
wait,
is the
just so that we kind of underscore that, we are vehemently agreeing with one another.
And number five is, it's not that we agree or disagree. It was that I was obnoxious and annoying while I did it. That was the problem.
Okay, I'll try to be more obnoxious and annoying.
To the point where people thought I was saying that a $50 million budget is not a big budget for France. It is. I understand that. But I couldn't even get that idea across. At number five is The Jungle Book, $18 million over the weekend, $860 million worldwide. I'm not sure what territories it has left, not sure where it can pull in more money, but that's certainly already a huge success story, but it would be fun to see if that could cross the $1 billion mark. I think there's like 25 movies in history, and as I've said, in about 5 years, we're going to have 100. To get into the top 50 of all time, you're going to have to gross $1 billion, and that's going to happen in about a week.
I don't know about a week, but yeah, it's going to happen soon. I look forward to The Jungle Book 2 when somehow Disney is able to, you know, add a sequel to Rudyard Kipling's work.
Did I mention I went to a drive-in last week and saw The Jungle Book and Zootopia?
No, you did not.
Oh, I did not. Oh,
you said you were going to. Oh, no. Actually, you did that a couple weeks ago. Yes, you did.
Yes. So I saw them both. Jungle Book was not good. It's the complete opposite of the stories by Rudyard Kipling. The stories are like brutal and cold and like, no, the jungle is vicious and harsh. And at the end, Mowgli, spoiler alert, it was written in the 1800s. In the end, Mowgli has to leave and go into civilization. In the movie, all the animals hug each other and Mowgli stays. But Zootopia was great. At number six is a comeback film in a way for Shane Black. My God, at Cannes, we're going to talk about Paul Verhoeven having a career high with his movie L. Here's Shane Black getting good reviews as a director. The Nice Guys, $12 million over the weekend. Not doing great, not burning it up. It stars Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling. But people are like, hey, it's great to see Shane Black back. In fact, he almost never got good reviews in his career. So it's kind of a shocker. Like, I guess you hang around long enough, people develop a certain affection for you. And number seven is the Divergent series, Allegiant. There's a series that has hung around and lost affection. Nobody really cared for it much at the start, and that's fallen with every movie. It made $11 million over the weekend. It's at $170 million worldwide. This is a movie where they really should not have split up the final book.
Yeah, and we talked about that we kind of disagreed with that, and it turns out we were right.
At number eight is The Wailing, a horror flick, grossed $11 million over the weekend, $32 million worldwide. And number nine is the Jodie Foster film Money Monster, starring George Clooney. $10 million over the weekend, $36 million worldwide. It's just starting its campaign. And at number 10, talk about well-reviewed, it's Zootopia. I was shocked how good this movie was. I'm not shocked, but I'm like, wow, no, it really is good. $6 million over the weekend, $981 million worldwide. It's hitting DVD and Blu-ray like in a minute here in North America. I'm sure the same is true for a lot of the world, but hey, check it out on the big screen. Push it over the $1 billion mark.
It only needs $19 million.
Yeah, and made $6 million this week. No,
$6 million this week.
So it could very well get there, but it is rushing towards the end of its run, so we'll have to see how quickly it falls, if it can scrape its way there. I think if Disney wants it to, it will.
Well,
right? I mean, if they want to make it happen, they can re-release it or give it a little push. They can do something to make that happen, right?
Yeah, they probably, well, certainly, I don't know how they would do that here in North America, but they could do it overseas, maybe.
And that's the top 10 around the world, and we're just launching the summer box office season, but we've already got fallout from a movie that sort of did not do great in the spring. I don't know whether it's not a flop commercially, Batman versus Superman, though every time they talk about the movie, the cost of the movie goes up. They're like, it cost at least $300 million. That's what the latest report is, according to Hollywood Reporter. Well, now, if
I think it depends on how much money Warner Brothers wants to write off.
Yeah, well, legally, of course, I don't think you can do that. But,
well, yeah, I know.
But anyway, so if it costs $300 million, it barely broke even, if that, when you count the marketing and all that. More importantly, they're worried that it has not properly and positively helped, you know, add steam to the DC universe, right? So something happened. It's not just fallout from this one movie. It's fallout from the first film, the first Superman film, now this one, now the whole vibe of where they're going and how much it's progressing, right? I mean, it's not like one movie opened poorly and they fired a bunch of people. That's not what's happening here, is it?
No, it's more the direction that DC Comics in their films are taking. I mean, they tend to be, you know, one after the other tend to be, yeah, not all that great, except for the Batman series that Christopher Nolan had charge over.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that was where the auteur was in charge, right?
Right.
Right. So what's happened? There's been a major shuffle of executives involved in the DC universe. What's going on?
Well, it looks like they created DC Films. Okay, so that's the first thing they did, much like Marvel has their own film division. And they put John Berg and Jeff Johns overseeing it, I guess. And they've actually kind of divvied up the different franchises there at Warner Brothers. So there's going to be like genre teams for Lego movies and Harry Potter movies. And now
so this
DC
is well
films.
Beyond just the DC movies. I mean, Warner Brothers really has rethunk all their franchises.
Yeah, but we said that. Remember, we were talking about how Warner Brothers was kind of on shaky ground because nobody knew who to turn to over there to do certain things.
Right, exactly. So who's in charge of the DC movies?
Well, as I just mentioned, John Berg and Jeff Johns. Zack Snyder, who kind of was the big producer and director of the two Superman movies, it looks like his influence might be trimmed down a bit.
And Charles Roven, this was just announced today, he's been a top producer. He's been day-to-day on a lot of movies, and apparently he's negotiating to move away from day-to-day to more of an executive producer role where he's overseeing things. Their spin is he's wildly important and nobody can be day to day in all these different projects. We're doing too many of them. So his role has to change. But there is the sense that it's fallout from an unhappiness in the direction of where these movies are going.
Yeah, I mean, now I will say that Suicide Squad, at least from the trailer and the advanced word of mouth,
looks
amazing. And everybody is really looking forward to that. But, you know,
I've never heard of the comic books and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, who had heard of Guardians of the Galaxy? Now,
right,
I know
exactly.
We're going to get email with like 1,000 people saying I'd heard of it. But I mean, it wasn't Superman. It wasn't Batman.
Iron Man was relatively obscure. So, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy and Suicide Squad are obscurer.
Wow. I think you just made that word up.
That's right. So that's what happened from a movie in the spring coming out and not meeting expectations, which is probably the best way to describe what happened to Batman versus Superman. And now we've got a summer with a lot of movies. We've got 16 movies with budgets of $100 million or more. And they're wanting, you know, it's a bloodbath. You can't possibly succeed. There's one movie after another. But I feel like if you look at the spring, we've had one hit after another there. Every 2 weeks, it looks like, or 3 weeks, there's a big hit. Kung Fu Panda 3 in January 29th. Now, it underperformed from what I expected, but it's certainly a success story. Deadpool, massive hit. Zootopia, March 4th. Batman versus Superman made $900 million, made more than the first Superman movie. It may not be a hit compared to its budget, but it certainly made a lot of money. The Jungle Book, Captain America, Angry Birds movie. That's every couple weeks you're having another big hit. So now we've got a string of movies coming out in the summer. Obviously, they won't all work, but there's no reason why they can't, right? I mean, if you're good, you'll make money.
Well, this was the big argument in 2014 for the summer box office, that it was down because there were too many big, giant movies opening up against one another. And we said, well, yeah, there were too many big, bad, horrible exactly. movies opening up against one another. But yeah, I mean, you can actually, that's that game theory where, you know, if you have too many people going after the same prize, nobody winds up getting it. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think some of these movies will probably fall off rather quickly. I'm looking at Warcraft.
Mm-hmm. Which got a good review from one of the trades and a bad review from the one review said, wow, it's really not that bad. The other one said, oh my God, who cares? But that may make it up worldwide. You never know. But it is based on a video game, much like the Angry Birds movie. But the Angry Birds movie had a much lower budget of about $70 million. Warcraft cost $160 million. That's David Bowie's son is directing that. So we'll have to see how it goes. It's getting some mixed reviews in the trades. It's certainly a well-known property. There's that IP again, right?
Yes, that's yes. We talked about that in our lead up to today's recording. We actually
not enough.
Yes, basically IP, intellectual property. It's basically the franchising and branding of content. That's really what we're talking about.
And almost all of these movies are IP that we're looking at, the big summer blockbusters. X-Men Apocalypse. In North America, it opens up May 27th, the same weekend as Alice Through the Looking Glass, the new sequel to that movie starring Johnny Depp. Another Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Warcraft, Finding Dory, the Pixar sequel to Finding Nemo, Independence Day Resurgence, the reboot of that series, not reboot, but sequel without Will Smith, The BFG, Spielberg's film based on the beloved children's book by Roald Dahl. I don't love it, but others do. The Legend of Tarzan, A Female Ghostbuster, Star Trek Beyond, Ice Age, Collision Course, Jason Bourne, Suicide Squad, and Ben-Hur. Those are the big summer movies. Most of them will get poor reviews.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not looking forward to seeing Ben-Hur. I saw maybe 15 minutes of it and just thought, wow, this did not need to be remade at all.
And why isn't it at Christmas time, I wonder?
I think...
Well, I mean Easter.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if it was ready yet. Mm-hmm. I know they're still finishing.
Already know there are question marks around Ghostbusters with the bad buzz for the trailer, but hey, let's wait till we see the movie. That's the same of all of these.
Having seen 20 minutes of it, yeah, I can tell you. I should probably stop seeing like 20 minutes of movies and start seeing the whole thing.
Yeah. Warcraft, The Legend of Tarzan, they're all big question marks. I mean, I don't know anybody even thinking about The Legend of Tarzan yet. Maybe the marketing campaign will kick in and we'll get excited. We already know Alice, X-Men, Ninja Turtles, Independence Day, the BFG, Ice Age. They're all likely to get poor reviews, with only Finding Dory potentially mixed in there as well. So the only possible critical and commercial hits are Star Trek Beyond, Jason Bourne, Suicide Squad. And I would have included Ben-Hur, but you say you've seen 20 minutes of it and it doesn't look good, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it might wind up being a 2.5-hour movie, so that might mean nothing.
Right, but I mean, if you know, you're not excited to see it.
No, I'm not. Not
so as usual, it's another summer of crappy movies, but most of them will be commercial hits, I think, right? I mean, they're not all going to flop.
They're correct. I mean, Finding Dory will do well. Ice Age will, you know, look, the previous films were record breakers for animated films in certain territories. So, yeah.
And I don't think there's any particular reason if they were good, and I just mean that commercially, not necessarily critically, but if they were good, that they couldn't, most of them make money. I don't think there's a lot of, oh, there's so much capacity. I feel like when you see a good movie, I saw Zootopia, now I'm ready to go see another movie.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, not everybody's like that, especially when you have children and you have to bring them along and all of a sudden, you know, going to the movies costs $75. So yeah, but I think after a while, and you can kind of, I saw this in Cannes with filmmakers, and maybe this is just because in Cannes, it's an auteur-driven environment, but people seem to be really sick of capes and tights. They're not though.
Not worldwide.
Well, exactly.
You're talking to the critics at Cannes. That's hardly the world that we're talking about.
Yeah, it was more than just the critics. It was more the you know, acquisitions executives and.
Yeah, but they're not the public.
Well, exactly, and I think they're tired of having to purchase and sell such movies. Really.
Ah, well, there you go. But family films, you've got Alice on May 27th, and then you've got 3 weeks before Finding Dory. Oh, I'm sorry. Then 2 weeks later or a week later is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Then 2 weeks after that is Finding Dory. Then 2 weeks after that is the BFG. And then 3 weeks after that is Ice Age Collision Course. So you have five movies really geared towards families. Now, families will go to Star Trek Beyond. They'll take their kids to X-Men and take them to Independence Day. But as far as films really geared towards kids and families, those are it.
Yeah, and I wonder if, as you know, parents who are taking their kids to all of those family movies, they kind of have to skip over X-Men Apocalypse or Star Trek Beyond or Ghostbusters because, you know, they've just been to the movies to see, you know.
Well, it depends how old their kid is. And more often, they seem to be taking kids younger and younger to older movies, right?
Yes. Yes, that's true. So it'll be interesting to see how this kind of plays out.
I think it's pretty rare that movie just flops because it was great and it could have made a lot of money, but it was released when a ton of other movies were making a lot of money too. Usually it's just the movie failed on its own terms.
Yeah, and the marketing and the way it was really, yeah.
That's what I mean by its own terms, right?
Yes, correct. Well, we're talking about all these big summer blockbusters. I know Jason Bourne is coming back with Matt Damon, actually, reprising his role.
That's right. And now Universal says, okay, we've got a Monsters universe and they've got a Marvel and they've got a DC and they've got a Star Wars. We want a Robert Ludlum cinematic universe. I go, really?
Yeah, that was a little...
But Robert Ludlum has sold 300 million copies worldwide and counting. He's dead, but his books keep coming out, written by new people, new books with the same characters like Jason Bourne. Dwayne Johnson is going to star in the Janssen Directive. He's going to play Paul Janssen, who is a former operative turned private security consultant. So that's another series that Robert Ludlum has. I guess they'll start crossing over. Maybe Jason Bourne will pop up in that movie for a second. And, you know, now they have a team overseeing this whole universe and they've got other projects, you know, that they're working on, but they want a Robert Ludlum universe. I don't know if it's distinctive enough to be considered a universe. I don't know if, but, you know, you sell 300 million copies of your books. You got a 4 or 5 different characters you can spin off into franchises. I guess they're going to go for it.
Look, it only took them 15 years to realize they should do that.
And it only took 15 minutes for the people attending Con to scratch their heads over the award winners.
I don't even think it took 15 minutes. I think it took 15 seconds.
Yeah, there's often a disconnect between the, like, what is it, 5 or 6 people on the jury?
Well, I think it's more like 9.
And all the critics and people who attend. The people who attend, they get all excited by movies. But, you know, you put any 5 people in a room, they might be excited by different movies. And when it's 5 actors and directors and all that, they're seeing movies, they're trying to avoid all the other buzz, and they get excited by movie A while almost everybody else loves movie B.
Right, and as Thierry Frémaux pointed out to Ann Thompson at IndieWire, you know, it isn't a festival for critics. It's a festival for, you know, for filmmakers and films. And it's more than 5 people. It's, in this case, I believe 8 people. And it had everybody from George Miller, the president of the jury, to Donald Sutherland, an actor, Kirsten Dunst, Mads Mikkelsen, and Vanessa Paradis, I believe, was also on the jury this year.
So what happened? What happened?
Oh, okay. So yeah, I guess we should talk about that. So the Palme d'Or, the very top prize, went to Daniel Blake, from director Ken Loach and screenwriter Paul Laverty. This was a film that kind of, we talked about this last week. Ken Loach is often seen as the socialist director, the lefty director. And
compassionate and humane universe, telling stories of the working class.
Right. And this time he kind of takes on the social welfare system in the United Kingdom and how it's kind of broken, really.
Well, it opened early in the fest and got very good, friendly reviews.
It was the first movie
I heard of, like, wow, this could be one of the best movies of the year. Cannes off to a great start. That's my impression. But you all were like, yeah, it's good.
It's good.
We've seen
not
it before.
Great. Yeah, but a little contrived and as such a little predictable.
But it won the Palme d'Or. And I have to say, it's the second time Ken Loach has won because he won for The Wind That Shakes the Barley. And I have, you know, in this case, I have to say, I saw that movie at Cannes. I loved it much more than most of the people around me. I was thrilled when that won the Palme d'Or and people sort of scratched their heads over that one, too.
A lot less so, because that one you could see was a solid movie. I mean,
and a career capper.
Yes. I mean, you looked at that and went, wow, okay. Congratulations, Ken. You've really done a great job on this, and you've really kind of, I mean, you're in your 70s and you've made this great movie. I think he was 69 when he won the Palme d'Or. Now he's 79. And so 10 years later, and he wins the Palme d'Or again for Daniel Blake. I almost wonder if that was a kind of consensus pick. Because
I'm sure that's what happens with the Oscars, right? You're passionate about this. They're passionate about that. And you all say, well, that's good. and you end up with the movie that's good rather than the one that you love that's great, because not everybody can agree on it.
Right. And then there's the Grand Prix.
Well, let's clarify here. The awards are announced in reverse order, of course. They lead up to the Palme d'Or.
Correct.
So you have a screenplay award for Asghar Farhadi's movie, The Salesman, to which everyone, good movie. You had a Best Actress award for Jacqueline Jose in Ma Rosa by Brillante Mendoza, to which people said, well, she was good, but there were a lot of great female performances this year.
And actually, let's pause on that for a second. This year specifically, I would say this was the year of the female performance. There were amazing performances in the Brazilian film Aquarius,
Elle with Isabelle Huppert by Paul Verhoeven.
Right. This was the film that was the last competition film to be shown, and people really liked it. They're calling it a comeback film for Paul Verhoeven, who and now, of course, every film he's ever directed is escaping me. But
Basic Instinct?
Basic Instinct, yes. Thank you. Why all
the
of a sudden I was like,
Yeah,
I was like, well, my goodness, my brain left.
Lots of button-pushing movies that would get mixed reviews but were big blockbusters after he moved to Hollywood especially.
Right.
But then recent years, he's done Black Book, right? And now this movie, showing an unexpected maturity. And this is a very button-pushing movie, too. It involves rape revenge, and it's Isabelle Huppert, and it's, again, a great performance by her by all accounts.
Right, and Ma Rosa, I saw it. I'm not a big fan of Brillante Mendoza, the Philippine director. I'm sure you aren't either. I don't know that this filmmaker has big fans. Film looked like it was shot on an iPhone, but it actually told a story, was way better than I thought, and she was very good in it.
Right, and then Best Actor was another actor from the Asghar Farhadi film, The Salesman, to which people said, oh, two awards for that movie? I mean, that was, that was okay. And I mean, I love Farhadi. I'm looking forward to seeing it, but he has far better movies from what everyone says. But
and we should mention that one of those movies from Asghar Farhadi won he's an Iranian director. He won the Best Foreign Language Oscar for A Separation.
As well, he should have, a masterpiece. So people are scratching their heads. They don't really quite understand these awards yet. Two for that Farhadi. What does that mean? And so we get to Best Director, and now people are really confused, right? It's a split award. Who got it?
Cristian Mungiu, the Romanian director, who has already won a Palme d'Or for 4 months, 3 days.
Well deserved.
Yeah, the great movie. He won for Baccalaureate, or Graduation in English. And this is a film that basically it takes helicopter parenting to a new level. It's about a father that kind of his daughter is attacked while she's taking her senior finals, and it could jeopardize whether she goes abroad for college, and all of the things that he has to do to try and make sure that she passes those finals and gets a certain grade, and really commenting on modern day Romanians.
What was the attack? What do you mean she was attacked? She was raped? She was assaulted?
She was assaulted, yes.
Oh, okay.
And there's, it's on video, and it's a very interesting movie.
But not a peak for the director.
Correct. Yeah.
Many other films that come, people went, that's good.
Correct. And one film that people really kind of went,
hated.
Yeah, I don't know about this movie.
Hated.
Kristen Stewart stars in it. Olivier Assayas directs it. He directed The Clouds of Sils Maria, for which Kristen Stewart won a César Award in France.
God knows why after seeing it.
Not
that it's her problem, but it's why that movie would get any attention, I can't imagine.
But here he comes again with the same actress, Personal Shopper. It's kind of this mystical, she's
ghost
kind of
story.
A...
Yeah,
it's a ghost story. It's a ghost story.
And again, people hated it.
People just were, very mixed to poor, yes.
So now these two movies, a shrug of the shoulders for Cristian Mungiu, and then a movie that they hated, get tie for Best Directors if they can't decide which one of these so-so movies deserves it the most. So now people are really confused, and then they get the runner-up prize, the Grand Prix, and we're skipping the third prize. Third place. We're skipping Andrea Arnold.
Oh, yeah. Andrea Arnold, American Honey. And that was the film where, the magazine subscription sales team of youngsters. Shia LaBeouf is one of the stars, and it's cast mostly with pretty much first-time, unknown, unprofessional actors. And it's, it was long.
It was a movie, right?
Yeah.
It was an auteurist film. And in the year of Cannes being dominated by terrific films by women like Toni Erdmann, which many people thought would win the Palme d'Or, something like Toni Erdmann or American Honey felt like the right movie to encapsulate what this Cannes was all about.
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, Maren Otte, who is the German director who made Tony Erdmann, which is a
shutout, nothing,
nothing, not a thing. And
right, so you're thinking with Andrea Arnold winning third place again, you're thinking, well, it must be Tony Erdmann, it must be Tony Erdmann, and then we get to the runner-up prize,
which goes to Juste la fin du monde, which stands for It's Only the End of the World by director Xavier Dolan. And he is the enfant terrible, as everybody loves to call him. I don't know why.
He's not really, but I mean, they hated Personal Shopper does not even begin to capture how much people disliked. People who liked Dolan said they disliked this movie. It's based on a play. I believe it's the first film of his that's not based on an original screenplay or original idea. He's adapted a stage play about a young man dying of AIDS, coming home to tell his family he's gay. A lot of big name actors in it. A lot of excitement for it. I love Xavier Dolan. I think he's a major talent.
Well, they knew he was gay. The family knew he was gay.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
They didn't know. And he never actually says, hey, I'm dying. That's the whole point. Right. But it's a...
Whatever. People hated the movie.
Oh, yeah, because it was just so... Yeah, it didn't work. And you really wanted it to after Mommy, Xavier Dolan's last film. And this isn't the
terrific.
First. Yeah, which was terrific. You really were hoping that he'd just hit it out of the park again. And this would be his Palme d'Or year. He would kind of break out the way Quentin Tarantino broke out in his 20s. This is a 27-year-old director. He could have, you know, everybody was hoping that this would be the film. It is not.
Yeah. He'll do it. I mean, he's already a major talent, so I'm excited to see it. But to have that win the runner-up prize, people are like, what is going on? The one movie they hated the most, you know, like...
This was Andrew a film Arnold. That actually got booed.
Yeah. Oh, well, and they love to boo. Let's not oversell it. People love to boo. But this was particularly lusty booing.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it was one of the few, if only, films actually shown on film. So they, you know, wasn't shown digitally. Uh-huh. And extreme close-ups of all the characters. And you know, look, I don't mind staring at Marion Cotillard for,
94 minutes.
But still, it was just like, there was a point where everybody in the film was just so shrill and horrible, which was kind of the point of the play. Mm-hmm. But you just kind of went, okay, I can't take it anymore.
Well, I still am interested to see it. He's made, this is like his sixth film.
Yeah, it's not his first to be based on work other than his own. I can't remember what the other one was. Is
Tom at the Farm? I mean,
maybe.
I Killed My Mother. Then the Ménage à Trois movie is definitely original. Then there's Tom at the Farm, Mommy. I'm forgetting the Lawrence Anyways. Lawrence Anyways is original. Heartbeats, I Killed My Mother.
Maybe Tom at the Farm? I don't know.
These are his own.
Okay,
maybe
yes,
Thomas.
It is Tom at the Farm, which was based on...
co-written with somebody else.
Correct. It was co-written and I believe based on a play.
A Michel Marc Bouchard.
Right.
So that too is based on a play. That's one I hadn't seen because it was virtually unreleased in North America. I think it's just come out on DVD. I'm looking forward to checking it out, but it was unavailable prior to this. So all his others were originals. This is his second based on a play. Tom at the Farm actually sounded like it was the most commercial of his movies, but because of who bought it and owned it and they went out of business, it just slipped through the cracks. And now we have this movie. So he has two or three more movies in the works. He will make other great movies. I think his feelings were hurt.
He has literally, I mean, in his interviews,
he's like, I hate all of you. You're mean.
he has really been pissed off. And I wonder if because this film got such averse reaction, negative reaction, whether the jury was like, well, let's award that film with something just to kind of, you know.
No,
you don't think so?
No.
Okay.
No, absolutely not.
Well,
they're not going to waste their runner-up prize just to snub their noses at someone. And they may not even been aware. They said they made a point of not reading reviews, not reading the press, they wanted to be in their bubble to just accept the movies as they were and not be influenced by what others were saying.
Well, and
so that led up to the Palme d'Or, which people went, he just won 10 years ago. Why does he need to win again? Why not something bolder and more original? Why not one of the great movies by a woman? Why not this, that, or the other thing? So it was a year of disappointment at Cannes, wasn't it?
Yeah, I will say it was not one of the better years in Cannes. There was no breakout film where you left going, oh my God, that was amazing, Carol, or Amour, or some of these, like No Country for Old Men, where you left the cinema going, that movie we're going to be talking about for years. There was no movie like that this year at all. And you know what? maybe not every year has to be that way, because if there was, then you would never be able to appreciate the great years where you have two, three movies.
I think it would be just fine if you had great movies every year.
Well, yeah, I mean, one hopes, but not every year can be that way.
Well, no, because you're just stuck with the movies that are available.
Correct. And you know what?
Of course,
one movie that is going to probably make some headlines is The Red Turtle. This is a Studio Ghibli film directed by a European, actually.
Yeah, this is an almost silent animated movie. It feels like it's based on a classic fairy tale of some sort, but it's original. There's no dialogue or almost no dialogue.
And it's directed by Michael Dudok DeWitt, or DeWitt, really. He's a Dutch filmmaker, and it's really quite good.
It's got lovely reviews. Again, you're talking Khan, the world first saw Tony Erdmann.
Correct.
Paul Verhoeven's L.
Yes.
The Red Turtle. Andrea Arnold's bold and crazy and nutty American Honey,
which I was not a big fan of.
Hell or High Water, which was a film noir that maybe stuck out just because it actually was a narrative pulpy movie, but got excellent reviews.
Yeah, I mean, it was like kind of a breath of fresh air coming in through that festival. From what I did not go to see that film. Yeah, you know, there were just too much going on.
But it's Ben Foster and Chris Pine. I mean, the Variety or Hollywood Reporter were saying this is Chris Pine's first movie outside of Star Trek where he really pops and can be, you know, a star and make it. You know, he's had these other movies and they haven't quite worked. And they're like, wow, this is it. You know, this is the one. He's going to break out. And it's by David McKenzie, who's a terrific director. You know, he's done some really interesting stuff like Young Adam. And it just looks like it's a... you know, so that's four movies already that, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing that could be on my best of the year list. So you say it was a bad con because you had to sit through it. But when I only have to check out the movies that are good, maybe it won't look so bad in retrospect.
Yeah, that's actually the best way to do that sometimes when you can kind of cherry pick the good ones and not have to sit through the Sean Penn, the last tale. I can't even remember the name of this film.
Oh, right. That movie that got bad. That was close. Only Xavier Dolan's movie was more hated than the Sean Penn movie.
Yeah, I mean...
And he's made some very good films as a director, but this one was pretty clearly a misfire on all levels.
Yeah, and down the Quasette over at the director's fortnight, the Quinzaine des Réalisateurs, Wolves and Sheep, the Afghan film by a female director, Sharbanu Sadat.
Did you see it?
I did not see it, no.
All right, another movie that may be one of the best movies of the year. Check it out. Now, if you've got, you've got the Camador and the director's Fortnite and the best movies of this and that and the other, suddenly you got yourself a list of eight movies that you should see that debuted at Cannes.
Yeah, and look, you only had to see 40 of them to get those eight. But think about it, that's like, a baseball batting average.
And Broadway had a pretty good batting average this year, too, didn't they?
Yes, they did. $1.3 billion in gross, which is the highest ever, and it's up 0.6%. You'd think, well, gee, that's not that's not that much. But it did it without, I don't think they raised ticket prices that much, did they?
Well, there's no they.
Well, that's
there's
true.
There's no they. There's a bunch of, every show is different, everything is different, and every ticket price setting is different. So, there's no they. But yes, 13.3 million people attended. It's the highest attendance ever, up 1.6%. I'm wondering if that's in the modern era, because I thought they had a lot more shows back in the old days, in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And so they say it's the most ever, but to me, I'm not sure about that. So I'm wondering, but certainly in the modern era, it's the highest ever. So highest gross ever, most attendance ever, and ticket prices actually went down. They dropped a dollar again, according to the New York Times, and Variety, for the first time in history, the average ticket price went down. It went down from $104.18 to $103.11.
Well, you said again that it dropped again.
No, I said it dropped for the first time ever.
Okay, so...
Again, as with the attendance, with the audience being the biggest ever, and the gross being the biggest ever, this was the first ticket drop ever.
Okay. Got it.
Since they've been paying attention, this is the first time people paid less on average than they did the year before. It's never happened before in Broadway history. The New York Times, bizarrely, thought that was a problem.
Okay.
I mean, what could be wrong? If you hit a record gross and have record attendance and your ticket prices don't cost as much, how is that a bad thing?
I'm not quite sure. I do know
did they think you're leaving money on the table when you've got... you know, $185 for Hamilton and all this, that, and the other. I mean, like, that's crazy. I think the reason ticket prices...
If you
prices
can get
went,
a ticket to Hamilton for $185,
you give me a call. I'm just talking face value, baby. So yeah. I think the reason it went down is because a lot of shows have lotteries for just 10 or 20 tickets a show, but they have online lotteries now. So people don't have to physically go to the theater. So if you're in the New York area and you can attend a show, you can sign up for a lottery and get access to a ticket and go to a show. You also have TodayTix, which is sort of a discount ticket service, which makes it easier, again, for people to spontaneously or quickly get a discounted ticket to a show without having to physically go down to TKTS and line up in the morning.
That's just to give people who have never been to New York City, in Times Square, there is a booth called the TKTS booth. It's usually very crowded because people are trying to get discounted tickets. And every day...
Right, so long-running shows like Les Mis that aren't selling out, they'll be there and have tickets for 30% off, 50% off, depending on the show, the day of the week, the performance, and all that sort of thing. So if you go during a weekday, you can see Les Mis in Chicago. They'll be on there for 50% off or something.
That's right. And some people come to New York, they only see shows that they can get through TKTS.
Sure, because who can afford full ticket prices? And they have booths downtown and in other boroughs, so not just in Times Square.
Okay.
But again, you got to get there. You got to get in line. You got to stand in line for an hour, maybe, depending on the day of the week. And you're not guaranteed of anything. And, you know, it's hard to do. And unless you're a tourist and have the time and that's what you want to do. Yeah. But TodayTix is this online service that a lot of shows use now. They get discounted tickets, make them available the day of. And then you can last minute say, all right, I'll spend $50 and see this show.
So it's like the Uber of Broadway tickets.
It's nothing to do with Uber. There's not that. I believe that people are paid. I don't believe they're independent freelancers. It's just an electronic service to help
I meant
people
as a disruptor to the Broadway
it's not a disruptor as such. It's that they've got tickets going to selling, and instead of forcing people to stand in line, they can now do it online. It's easier. So if it's easier to get access to these discounted tickets, more people will buy them, and I think that's what brought the ticket price down a little bit. Every time I go to a show, there's the TodayTix person in their t-shirt standing there with envelopes of tickets for the people who bought them waiting to hand them out. So you see that at every show now, and that means to me, tickets that probably would have gone unsold are being purchased, and they're being purchased at a discount, but everybody wins.
Well, the big winners this year were The Lion King, which is, I guess, 18 years old.
And, 18 years young.
Yeah, and it's grossed $102.7 million last season and $6.2 billion since opening worldwide. It's been seen by 85 million people during the course of its run all over the world.
Right. It's the biggest entertainment single property in history. No single movie or TV show or album or book has made more than The Lion King theatrical musical.
Hamilton, which just opened.
Well, it just opened. Hamilton, of course, was the big noise of the season. And saying that The Lion King made more, it's on a house with a lot more seats. So there you go. Hamilton, if it could have triple the house size, it probably wouldn't be as good a show. But they would be able to sell more seats and make more money. They're still week in and week out. They're often the number one show now. So I would say in 2017, we'll have to see what it's like when the cast starts to rotate in and out and Lin-Manuel Miranda leaves. I don't think this is a show that people are only going to see because of the original cast. I think they're going to keep going.
I agree.
I don't think for all of Lin-Manuel's fame and deserved attention, I don't think there'll be a misstep at all when there's a new guy playing that part. I think people keep flocking to the show. I mean, this original cast is sensational, but I think, you know, it's going to run and run and run. So I think
it's become a phenomenon. So yeah, it's
crossed over. In 2017, despite having such a small house, I think like the Book of Mormon, it has the potential to triumph for an entire year the way The Lion King did this year.
Yeah, I mean, so that show came in fifth place, earning $74 million behind Lion King, Wicked, Aladdin, and The Book of Mormon. So Disney had two shows in the top five.
Yeah, Disney is just on fire on Broadway. I mean, Aladdin has really become a long-running smash hit. That's a big success story. Mary Poppins was one of the 25 longest-running shows in Broadway history. They had Beating the Beast, The Little Mermaid. They've had their misfires, but they're really doing a great job on Broadway.
But it's those musicals that kind of soak up most of that $1.3 billion gross, and plays kind of earn about 20% of that, if that.
They tend to run less. They don't run as long. They tend more to be star-driven. I think there's a lot of other places where you can see good drama on television and film that gives you the burst of drama that you see on Broadway, whereas musicals, there aren't a lot of other places to see them.
Actually, 13% of the Broadway gross went to plays this season.
Yeah, so if you want to see a good musical performed, you can go see one or two movies a year, literally, that are musicals, maybe. You know, you can see some TV shows with some music in them. But really, you want to see a musical, you got to go to live theater.
Right, so, and they're more expensive, too. I mean, when you think about it, the ticket prices are usually a little more expensive.
No, it depends on the star. No, you know,
well,
you
that's
got,
true, too. Yes.
You got Julia Roberts in a play, it's going to cost you the roof. So it's not that, and that's not a draw anyway, that the ticket prices are more expensive. So we're saying why do musicals outdraw musicals?
Oh, no. I'm just talking about when you look at the...
Yeah, but they're more successful because they're longer running and it's the only place you can see them, whereas plays have a lot more competition, I think, from other art forms to give you a similar thing. But not that live theater isn't great. You should run them out. Go see them.
The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime was the highest grosser, earning $32.9 million.
A third of what The Lion King made. So the biggest play made a third of what the biggest musical made.
Right. And then, you have China Doll with Al Pacino earning $12.6 million and Misery with Bruce Willis earning $12.5 million. Again, those are star-driven vehicles. And even though they were kind of really poorly reviewed, because those stars were in them, as you say, Michael, the ticket prices are a little higher. And
absolutely.
The demand is a little higher.
I mean, they're limited runs, and those are the number two and three plays of the year.
Exactly.
The Broadway is really dominated by musicals.
And that's a big deal.
Absolutely.
Yes, that was my really poor way of moving us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, let's stick with theater. In this case, the National Theatre of London, which is kind of, they're saying, hey, critics, guess what? You can still come and see our shows, but you can't bring a guest. We're scrapping the plus one thing. And
what?
No more guests to the shows at the National Theatre. And oh, by the way, we want to invite more diverse media, not just the theater critics. We want there to be, more diversity amongst those critics covering the National Theater.
And they say they've got a finite supply of tickets, which is true. And their argument is, look, we've only got so many tickets to go around. We've got 8 million websites clamoring to do reviews. So sorry, you're out of luck. No guest. It's a nightmare. This is a big deal. If I don't have an extra ticket to a Broadway show, I will not have any friends.
So we know
how obnoxious I am. The only reason people talk to me is because I got a second ticket to see Hamilton at the Public, and then I got a second ticket to see Hamilton on Broadway. Everybody loved me then. Everybody was my best friend. Hey, Michael, who have you taken to see Hamilton?
I mean, the president of the United States couldn't even go with his wife to see Hamilton. He had to go on a separate day.
This is, I think, a sign of less power for print media.
Yes, that's
true. It's not that they want to invite 8,000 crappy little blogs, which they do. And sometimes I'm puzzled by the people they invite and give two tickets to shows. I'm really flummoxed sometimes, but they do it. Thank God, because I'm one of them. But I am one of them. I'm like, why are you giving me tickets to shows? But so I'm thrilled. I'm happy. I'm delighted. But yeah, it's really hard. The number of people demanding access is, 100 times what all you had were the newspapers and radio and TV. Now you've got 10,000 people who can legitimately say, oh, I've got 40,000 people on my website and they all love theater. So it's hard for them. And we've seen this before for limited runs here in North America, in New York City at St. Anne's and Brooklyn Academy of Music. Those are places that bring in shows. They have short runs and they're usually acclaimed from overseas with big stars and a lot of attention for them. And they only offer one ticket. And I understand that because they're only running for like 2 weeks. There's most of the tickets are usually sold out even before the show opens or the attention they can get is limited. There's no upside to them. It's not a long running show. So they can't afford to splurge on that many free seats when they've only got 2 weeks to try and make back the money they spent to bring it. But the National Theatre in London, they do long running shows. They do shows that transfer to the West End. They do shows that
it's like the public. Yeah.
It's like the public. That's scary. If that continues into the West End, into Broadway, people say, oh, boo-hoo, you guys are paid to go see shows, and now you're not going to get an extra ticket. I'm so sorry for you. Well, you know what? Most people don't make that much money or any money. I don't make a penny reviewing shows. So that's like getting to see them is the perk. getting to bring a guest is not just a nicety. It helps me in my review, someone to talk to about the show, someone to argue back and forth. You know, I know I take people often that will have an affinity for that show. If I'm seeing a silly, light, goofy musical, I know to take my friend TJ. If I'm seeing a really complex European type drama, I know to take my friend Gnome. If I want to see a vehicle and scout a new talent, I might take my friend Zoe. So, you know, I pair up the people with the shows that they will provide the best counterbalance to my personal taste, or I think that they're most likely to love it. So if I see that and they love it, that helps me in my review. You know, I'm not doing a consumer marketing survey, but I know their taste and I know that, and that plays off me, and it really helps me a lot. So it's not just, oh, gee, I want to take friends. It really does help to do a review.
Well, now, you know, as you're saying, sometimes, you know, there aren't enough seats to go around.
Well, there aren't, period.
Well, right. But how many seats do you think there will be? I mean, the demand for seats, that is, to this class that Angelina Jolie is going to be teaching. She's a visiting professor at the London School of Economics. This is a, you know, world-renowned institution, an educational institution. And now she's going to be one of the visiting professors there.
What is she doing?
I have no idea. I guess she is... It says here she will join the London School of Economics Center for Women, Peace, and Security as one of four visiting professors in a new master's program that starts taking applicants in the fall.
What will she be doing?
I have no idea. She's going to be delivering guest lectures.
On what?
I have no idea. Probably on, I don't know, foreign aid. I have no clue.
Do they not say in the article?
They do not really say, no.
The
and
New
this
York
is
Times.
From the New York Times, yeah. So they basically...
Well, that, it sounds like a big whoop. I mean, Brad Pitt might talk about architecture. You know, he's apprenticed with major architects, and that's his passion. He's done architectural projects in New Orleans and elsewhere. Angelina Jolie has done humanitarian work all over the world. I guess maybe it's going to touch on maybe her humanitarian work and the stuff she's learned about, or I'm sure she's knowledgeable about that area. Maybe, you know, Center for Women, Peace, and Security. I don't know her as much with women's issues as such, but
no,
I'm
no, no.
Sure
she most certainly has been.
I'm sure she's touched on it. Yeah,
with her double mastectomy and the. You know,
I know, but that's not her humanitarian work has been more refugee and children and things like that. I don't remember her. I'm sure she cares, of course. Who doesn't, about women's rights? But as far as what she might have international experience in, I'm just not sure. Sounds like a big whoop to me.
Okay, well, what about this? And I hate covering this, and you know that, Michael, but a judge ruled that there was enough evidence to proceed to trial on a 2004 incident, a sexual assault incident for Bill Cosby. Andrea Constand filed a civil suit that was settled in 2006, and now it's going... This is a criminal trial. This is something that you could go to jail for, and Bill Cosby will now have to face those criminal charges.
Well, I don't know why you don't like covering this. This is actual... criminal charges going to trial,
okay,
as opposed
to rumors,
the first rumor or the second rumor where you felt like, gee, I'm not sure what I should be. Once there's 50 women coming forward, that changes things. And once it's a criminal trial, I'm delighted to report on it. You know, let something go to trial. Let's find out what happens. Whether he's found guilty or innocent on this does not necessarily reflect his guilt or innocence morally, nor does it reflect on the other people who have accused. It just says there's evidence enough to go to trial. Let's see what happens. Maybe there will or will not be enough evidence to convict. It's very hard to convict in these cases. But, you know, 50 women have come forward. Clearly, there are things to be prosecuted. And thank God this one is recent enough that perhaps some justice can be had.
Well, we'll see how it progresses. Our next story, you know, as Amazon has literally obliterated the retail world, at least here in the U.S. I mean, there are department stores are struggling and malls are struggling and the big box stores are struggling, all because, you know, we buy everything on Amazon. Now we have Jeff Bezos saying that his little experiment of opening physical stores, they're going to expand.
They're going to do more. How many? Nobody knows.
Right. Whether that
like, will I don't help. Know. He calls it an experiment. He says they'll definitely do more. And it comes at the same time as they announced that they're launching an Amazon branded sort of grocery products like coffee and peanut butter and toilet paper.
Yeah,
so
this is private label stuff. That's
private label. Yeah,
yeah. That's kind of, you look. You know, Costco does that. Carrefour does that.
Every supermarket does it that I know of.
Yeah,
chain certainly does it. And Amazon is saying, hey, we should do that too. But, you know, you're doing physical stores. Right now, they've been bookstores. They're going to do more. Will they be doing a grocery store? You know, they've got basically the distribution all over the country, and they're deciding hey, maybe it's cheaper and better in certain cases to let people pick it up rather than ship it to them. Maybe that's a way we can add to our margins.
Right. And actually, in their bookstore and, you know, all the DVDs and books and all the media doesn't have prices on it. You know, it's pretty
well,
much
it's priced dynamically.
Correct. Yes.
Right. So that's nothing, no big deal about that. I mean, there's lots of stores where you don't find prices on physical products anymore, and it's hard to see which label on the shelf matches to that product.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
I was annoyed when they stopped stamping every, I used to do that as a bag boy. That's how old I am. Stamping physical stickers on every piece of product with the price on it. And if it changed, you scraped off the sticker and slapped on a new one.
Yeah.
That's how you price things. Now, then they switch to little bar graphs and things on the shelf. And now it's like, oh, just use your phone and we'll tell you what the latest price is.
And you know what else they're going to be doing? They're going to be seeing what it is you picked up and keeping track of that. And that way,
helps them sell you stuff online.
That's right. Speaking of selling stuff, the Met Opera, the Metropolitan Opera in New York City, grossed about 66% of its potential box office in the season that just ended, the lowest percentage ever.
So 2 feet away from Broadway, where they had the best year ever, you've got the Metropolitan Opera having its worst year ever in terms of box office gross.
And that's, so 20 years ago, it was averaging 90% of its potential box office. And of course, even 100% of total potential box office doesn't cover the cost of mounting an opera. I mean, usually they have to get grants and
no, they don't get grants as much as they just have a big trust fund and raise big money from, you know, major corporations and billionaires.
Right. And attendance at the Metropolitan Opera, one of the best opera companies in the world. I mean, I'm astounded at how many operas they put on, the productions they mount. It's remarkable. And this
have you ever been?
Oh, yeah. I'm a huge opera fan. And so, yeah, I go every time I can when I'm in New York. And I, you know, if it's a production that I'm interested in, especially, I've actually gone to New York City, you know, after I moved away just to see productions at, the Metropolitan. And, you know, it's remarkable to me that attendance is at about 72%.
Well, we know what the problem is, right? I can sum it up in one word.
Cost?
Death.
Death. Okay.
Death. The people who went to the Metropolitan Opera, the people who attended, the people who bought subscriptions that 20 years ago, you could not get a ticket in the 60s and 70s and 80s. It just was impossible. You couldn't get a ticket to anything because there were so many subscribers buying shows. They're all dead.
Okay. Yeah.
The Broadway is old. The Metropolitan Opera is older, and they are not replacing them quickly enough with younger people developing a taste and an excitement for opera. Now, they do say, Peter Gelb, the current head of them, he does say, look, we brought 72,000 new people into the Metropolitan Opera. So people were first-time buyers of tickets. They're coming. They're buying single tickets. They have not become so passionate yet that they are buying season tickets and that we're, you know, bumping back up. But that big era of people who just went to the opera, that's just what you did, that has passed away, and they're not replacing them yet with young people who are going to develop a new taste for opera. So people like you moved to LA. That's your fault. So, you know, they need more people like you who are young, who are excited by it and want to go to it, and maybe we'll subscribe eventually. They think that they're moving in the right direction, but this certainly is a tough year for them.
Well, you know who's not having a bad year? Adele. She's signing a huge contract with Sony Music. It's a $130 million, or is it million pound, which would just
be... No, dollar.
It's dollar. Okay, so it's really the biggest ever for a British act, the biggest ever for a woman. It's the fifth largest music contract, just behind Jay-Z's $150 million deal. I guess she's leaving her indie label, XL, for, you know, this big, you know, Sony Music. But she doesn't do endorsement deals, I've noticed. Not like, say, Taylor Swift, who can be found just about everywhere.
Right. So I'm confused. I mean, usually when you sign a record deal, she did it when she was 19.
Right.
And usually they last for like 7 albums. They have these crazily onerous contracts. And, you know, you sign for 7 albums, which if you do an album every year or 2 years, or she does an album every 4 years, it just ties you to a record label forever. You renegotiate after one or two if you have a hit, things like that. But instead, apparently that contract with XL has ended.
Correct.
And she's now free.
Yes.
So I'm not sure why that would happen after 3 albums, but apparently it did. Maybe it's in modern era and now they only sign 3 album deals rather than 7. Or maybe the contracts in the UK are different. maybe the years that you can be under contract has changed. They say, well, 3 albums or 10 years, something like that. So she's leaving XL, which is sad for them. They obviously benefited hugely, but they were the ones who rolled the dice on her. She's going with Sony, who already released them in the U.S. She's a big act, obviously, one of the biggest in the world. It seems like a no-brainer, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, even if her next album is horrible, it will still sell half as many albums as she sold this time around.
Yeah, well, so, you look at sometimes you sign artists right after their peak, you know, like Whitney Houston or Robbie Williams. You know, there's people who have been signed just beyond where they should, you know, they cash in just at the right time because they aren't going to be able to deliver in the future and the label suddenly gets stuck. But usually these deals are predicated on, you know, certain sales. She's not just handed a pile of $130 million. It's like a potential deal worth this much.
Right.
And everybody works together to make it happen.
Yeah, so the contract is worth $130 million, provided that record sales of each album reach a certain level and certain milestones are met.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite sure about that. I'm sure she has a per album, you know, she's going to get $2 an album or $3 an album sale or whatever, you know. I'm sure she has that royalty rate in there so that she'll make even more money based on how big the albums are. I'm not sure how they set it up, but it's not a simple, here's a check for $130
million. No, not at all.
And of course, some people say, well, she doesn't like to tour much. She's very private. This is something that should concern the label. But as far as we know, it's not a 360 deal. So they're not taking a piece of her touring.
No, but I guess the way they look at it is, touring helps sell the albums. These days.
Well, it is, of course.
Yeah, I mean,
and she's the only one selling albums.
Yeah.
But my big question is why we're talking about it, because it was only reported in The Sun. That's just not a great source. Or the Daily Mail, I think.
It was The Sun, and I thought, really? They're the ones reporting
this? Yeah,
and it's
been picked up by every outlet in the world, and as far as I know, nobody has commented.
Yes.
So I don't know what happened or what the deal is or when, and it hasn't happened yet. And this was like 10 days ago, I think, when this first came out. We were just too busy to cover it. So I'm just not sure what's going on. So take all of this with a grain of salt, because it didn't come from anybody like Billboard or anybody quoted on the record from Sony or Adele. It just came from the tabloids.
And they're always right. Now, speaking of being right, this next story has nothing to do with the last story. I don't know why I'm trying to merge them together here, but Netflix is ordering its first original series from Argentina. They have greenlit a 13-part series from Argentina called EDHA. Is that how you pronounce that? EDHA. It's a dramatic thriller set in the world of fashion, modeling, and music, focusing on a single mom / rising fashion designer, because of course all single moms are rising fashion designers. It will debut around the world in 2017 exclusively on Netflix.
I'd say it's a big deal, and because they probably had to do it.
I was going to say, you know, what with the EU basically saying, you know, Netflix, Amazon, iTunes, and all other streaming services, we're going to kind of mandate that you have 20% of your catalog be actual European films and content. They probably, you know, they said that they were going to do this. Now they're following through.
Well, you know, they may be doing them a favor, right? Because each country has their own standards. They range from 10% quota to 60% quota in France. France says you got to have 60% of your content. Maybe this will supersede that and it will become a pan-European standard so that they won't have to worry about country to country. It's unclear to me whether that is true, whether this would supersede France's particular demands. But that is possible. And what was surprising to me was that they pretty much already meet a 20% quota.
Yeah, and they have said, we're going to do local content. That's, you know,
right, when how local, you know, every single country in the world, you're going to do new series. I mean, that's awfully expensive. It's awfully expensive to launch a show in North America. It's even more expensive to launch a show in 87 countries. You know,
yeah.
Dude, that's 87 shows right there every year. I mean, that's one show. That's not going to be 20% of your content. So obviously they're doing a lot of pickups. They're picking up a lot of local shows that already exist. They cannot create original content to meet that demand. This is about saying, make sure that you're making available local French TV shows, local French movies. More importantly than the quota, perhaps, since they already match that, frankly, pretty much Netflix and iTunes are at 21%. So they're already matching this standard. So that's good news for them. But the more interesting thing is that they're being encouraged to invest in European TV and film production. You know, they don't just want you to, you know, to make movies. They want you to make it happen for everybody else, too.
Yeah, well, you know, look, there's a new buyer on the market. You got Amazon, you got Netflix showing up as new buyers. Now they're saying we want you to be new funders as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just, we don't want you just buying stuff that's done. We want you to help make the stuff that you would have bought if we had made it.
Well, speaking of funders, we had that Star Trek fan-based movie, the fan Kickstarter film that was going to be a prequel set in the early Star Trek era, and they were going to make it, and they had approval. They went to Paramount. It was all signed and above board, and then suddenly Paramount decided to sue and say, oh, we don't know about this. We have some update on that, which is that Justin Lin, who directed the new Star Trek movie, and J.J. Abrams, who directed the earlier one and is still producing them, they both have come out publicly and said they support this movie, that they think it should happen, and that Paramount needs to back off, and that's going to happen in the next few weeks. Obviously, you've got your director and your producer both saying back off. That's a powerful incentive to do so. I'm wondering how they'll do it so that they can protect themselves legally and not open the door to anyone and everyone doing Star Trek stuff.
Well, since we're on the topic of Paramount legal action, let's actually end Big Deal, Big Whoop, and move along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Not so sure, well, our first story isn't really going to affect many of our listeners, but over at Paramount, which is owned by Viacom, okay, we've talked numerous times about...
Well, it's not just Paramount, it's Viacom, right?
It's Viacom, yeah, yeah. Viacom, which owns CBS and Paramount. Right. Sumner Redstone is, you know, the largest share. Yeah, aging. He's 92 years old. He turns 93 in 2 days.
Okay? There were legal questions of his mental competence, but a judge ruled that he was.
Nah, the judge ruled that he made a decision to kind of kick somebody out of his house, and that was fine. Mm-hmm. That decision
wasn't
coerced.
He was competent to do that.
Right.
And so, but there's a tussle for power. We've got his, he's aging, obviously. He's not running stuff day to day. He's been chairman emeritus. They've been paying him money. And now they said, all right, we can't keep giving him $2 million a year. It's just silly. He's not actually participating at that level. His daughter, Sherry Redstone, is fighting for power. You've got Viacom CEO Philippe Domon fighting for power. And Sumner Redstone is caught in the middle. And now everybody is
suing everybody
back
else. Yeah.
Everybody's suing everybody. So he kicked out Philippe Domon from his trust, which actually is the major player in Viacom, right? I mean, that trust is
well,
the number...
Well, it's not the major... He's the major player right now, okay? Uh-huh. And the board. But what will happen is, should he pass away or become...
When
he passes away or, you know, becomes mentally unable to fulfill, you know, his duties, well, I guess really just make decisions, this trust will take over, okay? He, Philippe Domon, and one other person was kicked out of the trust that would be controlling the board.
The company that they are heading.
Correct.
And now his daughter, Sherry Redstone, who sort of lost the power struggle when Philippe Domon took power, she's going to be hopefully in charge of the trust as far as she's concerned, in which case she'll be able to tell them to take a hike.
Yes. I mean, originally...
They're all fighting for power over Viacom. This is what's going on. And you know, they're all worried about what they've said in the past and done in the future. For example, like a year ago, Philippe Domon said, Sumner Redstone is completely mentally competent. He's in charge of everything. He knows what's going on. He's an important person. Now he says, well, I wasn't talking about his decisions about Viacom. I was talking about his decisions about his mistress.
Right.
You know, don't hold my words against me.
And he also said, and that was last year, you know, he's aging.
Yeah,
and he,
a lot has changed, right?
Because
he
this
said he's
happened,
not competent.
This happened very quickly over the weekend. It happened on a Friday, suddenly, unexpectedly. And there's a lot of stuff going on that, I mean, Sumner Redstone said that, you know, Domon was one of the smartest people he'd ever met or known. You know, so, you know, there's now Domon and some of the board members are suing, saying that, hey, you know what, Sherry Redstone's pulling strings and saying that it's Sumner Redstone speaking, but it's not. It's really her changing wills.
Right. So
changing,
they're saying
yeah.
It's a bad idea to sell off Paramount or sell off a big stake in Paramount. I can guess, given his history, that Sumner Redstone would agree whether or not he's mentally competent to say so today. But, you know, that's happening. Who's in charge? That's happening. It's all up for a battle, and that's what's going on.
That's happening at Viacom. Meanwhile, across town at Warner Brothers, we have HBO. Okay, so HBO, owned by Warner Brothers, the head of programming, Michael Lombardo, is exiting after 33 years. This actually affects our listeners a little bit more because it will actually affect the programming that they get to see on HBO. Remember, this is a guy who was in charge of Game of Thrones, Girls, John, well, I guess John Oliver was the new guy who was.
Well, he was still the boss.
Yeah. I mean, so all of these shows that over.
The Jinx.
Yeah. And now, you know, so True Detective, for instance, and Vinyl, actually. Vinyl was also his. And, you know, I guess he had a few.
Everything is his. Everything up to today is his for, you know, he's been in charge for a while now and he's been with HBO for 33 years. So HBO, he sort of goes out on top, right? I mean, they had The Sopranos. How are they ever going to top that? It's never going to happen. They lost Deadwood and they came back bigger than ever with Game of Thrones. And so he can say, hey, I left with the biggest show in the world, practically by many measures, Game of Thrones. It's a monster. It's so huge. But the fact is that HBO has been sort of treading water for a little while. As always, when you have a big hit that's now facing the final two seasons, you say, what's next? And they're having trouble answering that.
Right. And so it looks like Lombardo was kind of pushed out a little bit. Kind of told.
They say, no, absolutely not.
Right, so he's going to be a producer at the at HBO, which is being quote unquote loosely defined.
Right, it's parting gift.
Yeah, like it, you know, look at Amy Pascal, kind of pushed out of Sony. She's a producer at Sony now. He says, "Look, I just want to be more entrepreneurial. So we're, you know, I'll be a producer."
Yeah. I'd rather not be the big boss. I just want to be an independent producer.
Right, Casey Bloys, who has is a fast rising star at HBO. He was in charge of the late night and comedy programming. Is now taking over for Michael Lombardo.
So he's not fast rising anymore. He's the boss.
Yeah, he's pretty much, yeah. Now, here's the thing. When Lombardo took over HBO's programming, it was a different world. Well, you know, I don't know when he took over.
I mean, he started working there 33 years ago. He wasn't the boss 33 years ago.
Right. I don't necessarily know when he took over, but he was in charge of Sopranos. So it dates back at least a decade or longer. Mm-hmm. There was no, you know, Showtime was kind of on the skids. There was no AMC or FX doing original programming. Netflix and Amazon, I mean, certainly weren't players in that.
He was the man. They were the man. Oh my God, HBO. Now they got so much competition, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you had a show that the studios didn't want, the networks didn't want, you turned to HBO if you were a creative. Now you can turn to HBO and, oh, by the way, about seven other places. So it's a little bit more competitive out there.
And they're really having trouble. Vinyl had a horrible first season. True Detective had a horrible second season. I mean, I remember when Vince Vaughn, I was so excited for Vince Vaughn. He got the lead in the second season of True Detective. Hey, great. He needs to be back on top. And it turned out to be, you know, oof, not such a good thing. They can't even get Westworld and Lewis and Clark off the ground. One is a miniseries. One is a TV show. They've both been halted mid-production. I mean, that's really bad when that happens.
Yeah.
And
generally,
so they are really floundering. And not just the fact that they haven't had a follow-up big hit. I mean, they have Veep, which is doing great, and, you know, and other things, but a monster hit. They can't seem to get things made.
Silicon Valley. That's a good show.
That's a good show, too. And that's all Casey Bloys, right?
Yeah. And, you know, John Oliver.
Right. And again, of course, Casey Bloys gets credit along with Michael Lombardo, who's the guy who's ultimately the guy who signed off on everything.
Correct.
You know, that's his bailiwick for Casey Bloys. But you got to give credit to Michael Lombardo as well there. But yeah, so HBO is in trouble. They've got a new boss. He's had good success story in comedy, which is the only area they've at least been scoring critically, comedy and late night. But though, damn it, they cannot get Bill Maher an Emmy, and he deserves it. Deserved it 10 years ago. But, you know, we'll see what he does.
Well, we certainly know what Morley Safer did. He was a correspondent and one of the hosts of 60 Minutes, and he passed away at the age of 84 last week.
More than 50 years he spent at CBS. And you know, he announced he's retiring like a couple weeks ago, and I don't think we covered it, but it was like kind of like, oh, you're still at CBS. But then he died just like literally obviously his work was his life. You know, I'm going to retire. Okay. I'll retire. And he's dead.
Well, didn't that happen to, the curmudgeon,
Andy Rooney?
Andy Rooney. Yeah. Like he said, okay, I'm signing off. And he passed away shortly thereafter.
Well, so apparently to never announce you're retiring from 60 Minutes. But this show obviously is an institution. He joined it in 1970.
And this is, we should say, for those of you who are living under a rock and may not know, it is a news show. It is a basically
it's a news magazine, a weekly show where they have three or four stories. maybe a celebrity profile, an investigative piece, and so on.
Right, and it's become important because it's broken numerous stories.
Well, it has been important for decades. It's a landmark show, and frankly, it's still in the top 30 or 40 of network television, depending on how you slice the numbers.
Yeah,
you know, that's kind of amazing. It's still, you'll see it in the top 20 some weeks in the overnights. You know, it's Sundays at 7. It's an institution, and Morley Safer was a big part of that.
That's true. Now, we're becoming an institution, in fact, and so much so that our listeners are writing to us to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. And oh my goodness, our little conversation last
Maybe
week?
Maybe I'll read it and then you can respond, since I should be the one to be chided.
Okay.
Hi, guys, says Greg Bridle from Hungary. Each week I wait for the latest Showbiz Sandbox and have to say that I miss those weeks you cannot broadcast. I listen right through to the end. God bless you. Regardless of how long, because you are both professional, entertaining, and informative. That was the case until last week. That was the first time that I stopped listening in the middle of a podcast. Michael, your rant, and there isn't a better word for it, was unprofessional and unbecoming of the journalist that we know you to be. Taking facts out of context, I don't know when I did that, and suppressing an opinion, I definitely did that, because it doesn't fit your view, isn't what we tune in for. And consistently calling someone, and anyone who would be open-minded enough to listen to them, an idiot because they didn't share your view on the world, said more about you than the person you disagreed with. Thankfully, we live in a world where we are all able to express our opinions without the need to suppress those of others with whom we may not agree. Hopefully, future episodes of Showbiz Sandbox will be ones I listen to until the end. P.S. In Europe, we do consider anything over $10 million for film production a big budget. That's because we consider spending very large amounts on film production unnecessarily wasteful and not necessarily a very good return on investment.
Which, by the way, I did run into the analyst from the European Observatory and
asked, the guy that delivered that report.
Yes, and he said, "Look, I was just stating historical figures. You know, I kind of made light of the fact that you know
he hadn't listened to this show, had he?
No, he had not. I told him I emailed him the link.
Discussed it. Yeah.
Yeah, and he said, "Look, you know, you name me one big giant movie."
The French comedy.
No, that cost 70 million euro or $70 million that didn't have Luc Besson's name on it. He said, yeah, there are the off, you know.
We know that. We know their budgets are lower.
Yes. And he said, you know, for
we
the
know,
most.
We know that 15 and 20 million. Again, this is me just not even being able to deliver what I want to say because of my stupid rant. We know that 15 and $20 million is a huge budget in France and England and Germany and Spain. We know that. That doesn't mean. But when you said, oh, you know, they're not matching the big blockbuster numbers of Hollywood, like 500 million. Well, of course not, because that's not the game they're playing. It's big. It's a big budget in context of France and Germany and Spain, but it is not a big budget in the context of Hollywood movies. So you should not try to mimic Hollywood movies.
Well, and I think what Greg Bridle was referring to is that last week when you said $10 million isn't a big budget. It's not
for a Hollywood movie.
Correct.
That's why comparing the grosses that they make to what you said, which was $500 million, they're not there, are they? Well, no, of course they're not. That's not the game they're playing.
That
$50 million is a huge budget in France. We know that.
They're really just trying to get European-produced films to travel either within the European Union or elsewhere. And
We have to get a list, and I tried to do it, and I didn't have time because I've been traveling. I went to Boston and Pennsylvania, and I'm back in New York, and I'm heading back down south in 10 days. But I tried to get a country-by-country list of the top grossing movies in France and Germany and Spain, or even Europe, outside of Hollywood, to see what the big European hits are. I don't know why in the last 5 years they would suddenly, most of the big hits in France, Germany, and Spain are English.
No. Well, they're, yeah, like 80% of the 80% of the box office is American movies.
Well, that, we know that, but we're saying if they want to make money, how are they, if they want to be successful, meaning I assume commercially and if they're lucky creatively, but mostly commercial is what we're talking about, right?
Yeah. You know, if they want to export.
They need to make them in English. If you look at the hits of the last 5 years, they're English and they win awards and they are dramas.
And they generally cost over $10 million.
Right. But I don't believe that is the case for actual French films. That may be the case for Hollywood movies released in Europe.
No, they're talking about European-produced films.
How many Spanish films released in the last 5 years were in English?
Yeah, well, that's... Yeah.
How many French films were released in English? I don't understand what the heck they're talking about. So a good reason to stop talking and try and actually get the names and list of movies that they're talking
about.
Or
maybe invite this analyst on and he can kind of...
Hell no. He doesn't want to talk to me. at least let's see what movie... And it's not his. It wasn't his. It was just an analysis of what others were saying or you know...
Well, report. It's an analysis of numbers, basically.
Right, but he didn't even necessarily write it, did he? Wasn't he just delivering it?
Well, he wrote it and delivered it.
Oh, he wrote it and delivered it. So yeah, let's at least see if we can get a copy of it and see what titles they're talking about. Because... historically, and even in the last 5 years, Europe has a bad history of trying to mimic Hollywood, where they say, let's make a big international co-production, and we'll have big stars, and they'll all speak in English. It's called Euro-pudding, and typically, it's been a disaster, both creatively and commercially.
Well, and you should see in Cannes that there's always, like, a snicker by, like, the second minute of the opening of a film where they're still going through the co-production companies, yeah. Where it's like, oh, my God, this is, like, the 50th, production company banner we've seen. Enough.
I would say historically the biggest success stories for French cinema and Spanish and German and British, it has been when they make something specific and local to their culture, and it doesn't have to be a drama and it doesn't have to be in English. It just has to be theirs and specific and unique, and that's what ends up being universal. It doesn't mean they aren't making broad, silly, goofy block Hollywood type movies. We see those comedies in Germany and England and France all the time. They do look commercial. They do look, I'm not talking about art films. They do make movies that can and do get remade, but the movies that work best feel very specific to them. And they are in French and German and Spanish, and tell them to make movies in English sounds weird to me.
Well,
and when you look at the countries, when you look at the countries that have huge flourishing industries, like Bollywood and China, and Korea and Hong Kong, they're not doing what this study claims is the way to success or what they claim has worked in the last 5 years.
Well, and we got a number of emails. And when you look at the emails, they're kind of pointing out how we are constantly saying, hey, you know what? There are no more platinum albums. There are no more gold records. Why? Because times have changed. The retailing has changed and the market has changed. So how can you compare what worked yesterday with what might work today? That is true. I mean, there is some truth to that. And if we're going to do it for one industry, in the case of music industry, then we might want to do it in other industries, such as, in this case, European films being exported.
Can you think of, but I cannot think of Europe films made in France, Germany, Spain, Russia, et cetera, in the last 5 years that were in English.
Personal Shopper.
That were big... Well, that's an art film, and it has not made a penny yet. Well,
no.
That the big success stories at the box office from Spain in English.
No, I would have to go and
France.
You know, Germany. There's no point in doing this now because none of us have the data. So,
well, I can't name any movie. You know, I mean, so it's weird.
Well,
so
we heard from a lot of you about as I mentioned, to dirt@showbizsandbox.com, including Mario Scott, who also talked about the big budget issue, that we just covered. But he also says, he wrote to us about our story regarding Amazon opening its video platform to the public. He writes, this service by Amazon is not like YouTube because it is not letting just anybody upload video. When you register, you have to put in a tax ID or business tax ID. Also, the videos must have closed captioning. Amazon.
He had a joke saying, That won't include any cat videos. But in fact, I think cat videos wouldn't need closed captioning because there wouldn't be any dialogue. But maybe that's just me.
Well, it says Amazon Video Direct, I think, is geared toward high-end YouTube channels and other high-end web video creators. I would agree with that, actually. Vimeo has more to fear from this service than YouTube. Also,
before we get on to the rest of it, I just want to say that's great because I didn't know any of that. And I didn't see that in any of the stories I read. But you know that's true, right?
Yes,
the stuff
that is
about
true.
The tax ID and the closed captioning and all that. So that's really cool. I'm glad. Thanks for writing into us and letting us know about that, because that does definitely clarify who they're going after. They're not going after cat videos. They're going after the low-hanging fruit of the people who are actually succeeding at YouTube. So that's very interesting. And then to put it on me, I'll read the rest of it. Also, I think Michael was missing the point on the segment about elements that are in European movies that cross over for international success. The report was just looking at the data and finding commonalities with movies released in a recent time frame. It was never said it was a formula. It's just qualities that those movies have in common. I don't want to bash on Michael. I don't know why not. But what is considered a big budget is very relative. There are not too many places where movie budgets are $100 million or more. Big budget would be anything above the normal of the market that an entity is in. If I was making a movie for $2 million in Nigeria, that would be a big budget movie. If I made a $2 million movie in the U.S., no one really cares. Still love the show, Mario Scott. To which I would respond, boy, if I'm such a schmuck that I can't even get across that I understand that, another reason for me to apologize. So thank you very much for writing in.
Well, and thank you very much for listening, hopefully, all the way to the end of the show. Again, dirt@showbizsandbox is our email address. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. I almost feel like we should argue here just to get more comments and feedback.
You just spoiled my kicker at the end. Way to go. That was when I was going to start arguing. Oh, well.
Well, you can find
It is unscripted.
That's very true. You can find all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find our show, and please do rate and review the shows on those platforms. It does help us out. You can follow us on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our username, or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on, well, their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's I Will Not Be Such a Jerk. .com.
Well, you know, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not try heading on over to the Huffington Post, or all of his work is aggregated at michaelgiltz.com, or you can always check out Book Filter. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.